Welcome to Off Mic with me, Michael Puente, on Lakeshore Public Radio. I hope you're having a great day so far. Well, if I sound a little winded, it's because I'm trying to get in shape to run a marathon. Well, actually, I'm not running, but we'll hear from a woman who is running in this weekend's Bank of America Chicago Marathon, and we get tips on how you can prepare for next year's event no matter how old or level of fitness you are. We'll hear about a woman who dedicated her whole life to protecting the environment in Chicago and Northwest Indiana. And we talked to an Army veteran who was deported to Mexico despite serving two tours in Afghanistan. We'll talk to him and the organization that's trying to help other deported veterans. We also get an update on where the Cubs are in their search for a new manager and find out what happened in last night's season opener for the Chicago Blackhawks. That's all coming up on Off Mic.
Officials say the Saddle Ridge fire had scorched 4,600 acres before dawn and destroyed 25 homes, continuing to threaten residential areas. Los Angeles Fire Department Chief Ralph Terrazas is telling citizens to heed evacuation warnings.
This is a very dynamic fire. The public can help us by listening to police officers and firefighter directions, especially when we're talking about evacuation.
There's been one fatality due to a heart attack. After the blaze erupted last night, two freeways were rendered impassable by heavy smoke. The UN says tens of thousands of Syrians have fled their homes in border villages in northeast Syria as Turkey's military incursion continues for a third day. Aid groups say civilians are in need of food and medicine. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from near the Syrian border in Iraq.
Doctors Without Borders says the lone public hospital in the Syrian border town of Tel Abyad has shut down. That town is seeing some of the most intense fighting between Turkish-backed fighters and Syrian Kurdish forces. Most medical staff and residents of the town have fled. Doctors Without Borders says it's aiding residents taking refuge in schools, office buildings, shops, and relatives' homes. The UN World Food Program says over 70,000 Syrian civilians from border towns have fled deeper into Syria, away from the Turkish border. It says it's providing meals to about 11,000 civilians and preparing food rations. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Dohuk, near the Iraq-Syria border.
Only a few House Democrats have not said if they support the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. As Vaughn Golden reports, one of them wants to review the results of the investigation and thinks the president should cooperate.
Upstate New York Democratic Representative Anthony Brindisi is one of eight House Democrats and the only one from the state who hasn't directly supported the impeachment inquiry. He thinks the president should cooperate with the investigation.
Whatever can be done to get witnesses to come forward, to have documents presented, that should be done so we can look at this.
The topic came up but didn't dominate his town hall event Thursday night, his first since the impeachment inquiry was announced. Brindisi reiterated that he is waiting to see the formal articles of impeachment drafted by the Judiciary Committee before making any decisions.
I'll weigh all the facts and then make a decision at that point.
He represents a largely Republican district and is facing a tough re-election in 2020. Vaughn Golden, NPR News, Utica, New York.
There are high hopes that top-level trade talks between the U.S. and China today will result in a partial trade deal and delayed planned U.S. tariff increases. The Dow up 390 points. This is NPR. The European Union gave Britain a deadline of today to come up with new proposals to break the deadlock over Brexit or face a cutoff in negotiations. Terry Schultz reports there are some tentative signs of progress.
European Council President Donald Tusk says he delivered the ultimatum to British Prime Minister Boris Johnson a week ago. Tusk says he informed Johnson that without compromises coming from the British side, there would be no chance to reach a deal on Brexit before the UK is due to quit the EU October 31st. But as time runs out on the deadline day, EU chief negotiator Michel Barnier said he and his British counterpart had had a constructive meeting.
Brexit is like climbing a mountain. We need vigilance, determination, and patience.
President Tusk says even with what he calls these optimistic signals, the UK has not yet presented workable options for settling the status of the Irish border after Brexit, and he says time is practically up. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Abiy Ahmed is this year's Nobel Peace Prize winner. Abiy is the prime minister of Ethiopia. He was honored by the Nobel Committee for making peace with neighboring Eritrea and ending one of Africa's long-running conflicts. Abiy calls the award a prize given to Africa, given to Ethiopia. The head of the UN Refugee Agency says the award to Abiy is a huge testament to his efforts to bring peace and making Ethiopia a model for other refugee-hosting nations. His other diplomatic efforts in the long turbulent region, including Sudan and between rivals like Somalia and Kenya. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include C3.ai. C3.ai's software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai.
Welcome to Off Mic with me, Michael Puente, on Lakeshore Public Radio. Miguel Perez Jr. grew up in Chicago. Shortly after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, Perez enlisted in the Army and served two tours in Afghanistan. Like other service members, Perez suffered from PTSD when he returned home. He had some trouble with the law and ended up serving a seven-year prison sentence. While in prison, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services moved to have him deported to Mexico because Perez was not an American citizen. He was brought here when he was only 7 years old. Despite serving our country, he was deported to Mexico, flying out of the Gary Chicago International Airport in early 2018. But just recently, Perez returned to Chicago to try to secure his citizenship. He did, and thanks in large part to the efforts of a group in Chicago known as Green Card Veterans. We're going to hear from Miguel Perez in just a short bit. But right now, we're going to start off with the president of Green Card Veterans, Carlos Luna. He joins us by phone from Chicago. Hey, Carlos, how are you?
I'm well, Michael. Thank you for having us on.
Oh, no problem. And thank you for joining us. Carlos, tell me real quick, how did you start, first of all, this organization? How big of an issue is of this issue of deported veterans?
Well, we're not sure of how big the issue is. A GAO report this June found that ICE and USCIS do not keep records very well. So the scope of the problem is still unclear. But as a veteran advocate, myself and the other Green Card veterans that helped found this, if it happened to one, that's one too many. And we just came together here in Chicago to try to stay the deportation of one of our fellow Chicagoans. And unfortunately, we were not successful at in stopping it. But like you mentioned, we were able to help bring him back in a year and a half to the date.
Let me ask you this. When you first started the organization, was it primarily to help Miguel Perez Jr., or were you looking into other service members who had been deported?
Correct. No. So the we really began just rallying around Miguel. Nobody was an organizer. We were just veterans and veteran advocates from here in Chicago. We primarily dealt with incarcerated veterans and doing restorative justice at the Cook County Jail and with helping veterans access their benefits here in Chicago. Deportations were not on anybody's radar until we came across a news article in the Chicago Tribune that had to do with Miguel and his church that was rallying behind him, and thought, well, let's go and see how he can help. And after that, we were invited to join them at in D.C. to speak to the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. And that's, I guess, when we really realized that this is a larger issue than Miguel Perez. And we were introduced to the League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC, which Green Card Veterans is a council of. And the rest is really history. We got a council of veterans and non-veterans who were interested in working to save Miguel from deportation, but also to address the underlying issues that we found lead to deportation, mainly access to appropriate health care and mental health care, jobs, all of the different systemic issues that non-veterans face are exacerbated by veterans because of the a lot of cultural issues that one picks up throughout the military. Excuse me. And then coming back, it's almost, the systemic gaps that veterans have to leap over are well documented.
Mm-hmm. Carlos, can you answer for me? Maybe some people might be interested in this. How is it that somebody who is not a citizen of the United States is able to enlist into the military?
And that's a very common question. And, unfortunately, there is no other answer than when we enlist in the military, we're a body. And so it doesn't really matter what your race, what your ethnicity, what your creed is, as long as you can perform the tasks that your contract says you need to perform. Now, I know that we would like to hope that people do not fall through gaps when we're in the military. But the reality is that, when you're serving in the military, everything is mission-focused, and personal needs are not part of the mission. They are military needs. So whatever your unit, whatever your company, whatever your squadron, whatever is on their agenda, that's what yours becomes.
Okay.
And so, it's easy to fall through those gaps.
So Miguel Perez Jr. returned to Chicago, I think, almost 3 weeks now, and he had this. He was on this temporary visa to try to straighten out his citizenship request with Immigration Services. And I guess last Friday around this time, he was really up against his deadline to either find if they're going to approve his citizenship, or he may have to return back to Mexico. And lo and behold, they did approve it. He became a citizen. But even before that, you guys traveled to Washington, D.C. to meet with lawmakers to try to assist other deported veterans. What exactly are you trying to have lawmakers do for them?
All right. Thank you. So you're right. We did not know if he was going to be able to stay longer than those 14 days that he was given. And so we thought that it was important for the lawmakers in D.C. who have the power to address this with legislation, hear what he had to say, given his experience. So there are different legislative proposals in both chambers that try to address this issue. Unfortunately, the people who have gone through this, who have been deported, are not always fitting into the criteria that has been put out for these. One that I can think of the top of my head is, honorable discharge, right? There is data showing that less than honorable discharges are often associated with some form of untreated or undertreated traumatic conditions, the conditions caused by trauma. So if we look at the data, some of these veterans may not be eligible for relief that they really are deserving of. So what we were hoping to do when we were in D.C. is talk to these congressional members to get them to do a hearing, a congressional hearing, mm-hmm. where we can subpoena veterans who have been deported and get their voices heard. Right, find out what is really going on in ICE detention, how they're being treated, how ICE and USCIS are not following their own policies and protocols when identifying these veterans. Nobody is condoning any type of criminal activity. However, we do feel that exile, because essentially this is what this is, exile is over the top for any of these. So that's the what we were hoping to get done out there. And, I mean, we had some follow-up meetings that seemed pretty promising in that people are wanting to listen to what Miguel went through.
Well, Carlos Luna is the president of Green Card Veterans based in Chicago. When we return, we are going to talk to Miguel Perez Jr. But Carlos, thank you so much for joining us here on Off Mic.
Michael, thank you for having me.
Can't make the big game? Or maybe you're at the big game and you want to know about the other big game. Lakeshore Game Night will take you to every game tonight starting at 6 p.m. Join Tommy Williams, Wayne Svetnoff, and their team of correspondents to get the latest scores and updates from the Doonland, Greater South Shore, Great Lakes, and Northwest Crossroads Conferences. It's Game Night tonight at 6 here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org.
Next time, it's the Friday Pitch-In when we catch up on the biggest Indiana stories of the week with our digital producer, Lauren Chapman, like a Democratic gubernatorial campaign launch, which was made official this week. We'll also mark the 50th anniversary of Ball State's Vietnam Moratorium Committee with one of its lead organizers. And we'll dig into some of the strange history and places in our capital city, highlighted in the new book, Secret Indianapolis. Next time on All In.
Tune in today at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Welcome back to Off Mic with me, Michael Puente. We were talking about the situation with deported veterans to Mexico, veterans who are not U.S. citizens, who, despite serving the United States military and the country, are deported, and there's really no pathway to citizenship. We heard from the organization who assisted one veteran in that situation from Chicago. And we're joined now by that very veteran, Miguel Perez Jr. from Chicago. Miguel, how are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Miguel, I almost want to tell you a happy one-week anniversary because of a week ago from today, you became a United States citizen. How do you feel after about a week?
Oh, I feel great. I mean, it was something that was a long time coming, and I'm still kind of in shock the way that things went down, but ultimately I'm just so happy and thrilled.
Now, Miguel, you know, in your story, which some people, I'm sure a lot of people have been following, you came back, you were deported more than a year ago, year and a half ago. In fact, you flew out from my understanding, from the Gary Chicago Airport right here in Northwest Indiana. You were in Mexico for about 18 months. You came back on this temporary visa, and a week ago, you didn't know if you were going to have to return to Mexico if immigration officials didn't give you an answer to your citizenship request. What was that experience like, not knowing whether you were going to be here in the United States or back in Mexico?
Well, it was very surreal. First of all, I was very happy to be back home after being away for such a long time. So I was, happy to be back. But like you said, it was only a 14-day visa. And time was running out. The last day was supposed to be Monday, and Friday was when they just called me up and said, "Just come over." And we took I took the oath and signed the paperwork, and they made me a citizen right there. But the days prior to that was just like being in limbo. Like, is this really going to happen? Are they not going to do anything? And do I have to return to Mexico? So I tried not to think about that. I was just focusing on the present, on the here and now, being around our family members and friends.
Miguel, what do you say to people? There are people, who have strong opinions on immigration issues, as you know, undocumented, path to citizenship. What do you say to people who say, well, people who are here illegally, they need to go back and do it the right way? You were brought here when you were a child from Mexico, and, you enlisted into the Army. You're about to give your life for this country, and then you were deported. Why do you feel that should not be allowed to happen to those who are serving in the military?
Well, as far as as research goes, and as far as we know, there's no such thing as illegal immigrants in the military. Everyone that joins in the military is a permanent resident or some sort of legal status that allows you to fight for the country that you live in, the country that that you love. Because most people join, some people join for the experience, or they want to. The recruiter tells them, "Well, join. You get to travel or money for college." But in my case, I joined for the love of the country, and I've never met anybody that was illegal or heard about anybody that's been illegal in the military. And in my particular case, my grandfather's a natural born citizen of the United States, and his family before that. So when I came here as a child, I came here as a legal permanent resident.
What was your experience like living in Mexico as a veteran, but one who's deported now?
Well, it's very difficult, because an American citizen can go down to Mexico and live there and travel and doesn't have to fear violence is everywhere in the world, but you don't have to necessarily fear it, because you count with the U.S. government. You know, if anything happens, criminal groups down there, they don't want that attention of hurting an American citizen. But once you're deported, you're just open game. And when they find that out, that you have military experience, that you're a combat veteran, and that the U.S. doesn't want you, that you just got kicked out, you're a target. You're a target. So it was very difficult for me to maintain a life with that fear, with those threats, because the threats are real. They come in from everywhere. People, especially since my case was very public, I had to constantly be on watch. And the group of veterans that I met down there is a community. They keep together, most of them. But since it's a lot of problems when it comes to mental health and or just regular health, because there's no such thing as a VA down there or anywhere that one can go seek medical attention or mental health attention.
Miguel, we just got a few more minutes here. My last question to you is, you were on Capitol Hill meeting with lawmakers not even 2 weeks ago. What are you hoping lawmakers do for other deported veterans who were exactly in your situation? What do you hope lawmakers do?
Well, what would really be the best scenario for this would be an executive order. Maybe pass a bill. If it's not an executive order, maybe pass a bill through the House and the Senate that allows deported veterans to come back to the country that they serve and were willing to die for.
Miguel Perez Jr., thank you so much for joining us on Off Mic, and thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. You're more than welcome. I did it for the love of the country, like I said, and thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. And coming up on Off Mic, we'll talk about the joys of running for 26.2 miles.
We're going down on the farm with Let's Eat. This Friday, we're traveling to Maryville Farms. Let's meet at the barn, pull up a bale of hay, and visit with Ginger, the farmer's daughter, that runs day-to-day operations of Maryville Farms. Call in 769-9577 and ask Ginger your horticultural questions and win a gift card from Maryville Farms. Visit the farm this Friday at 3 o'clock on Let's Eat with Sharon Jackson and me, Chef Nick, as we pick pumpkins with Maryville Farms on 89.1 FM, Lakeshore Public Radio, WLPR. Call in and join the fun. Yasu. Let's go down to Junior's Farm.
Well, Sunday is the annual Bank of America Chicago Marathon, the 26.2-mile trek throughout the city's neighborhoods from North Side to South Side and downtown. The marathon attracts runners from near and far, including many from Northwest Indiana. While some runners are finely tuned athletes, some aren't and are doing the race as a personal goal. Glenda O'Meara of Portage is running in her fourth Chicago Marathon, and she joins us in studio on Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio to talk about her experiences and what does someone like me, just your average Joe, prepare to get out there next year. Hello, Glenda. Thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Well, tell me, this is your fourth marathon you're running. What is it about marathons that you love so much?
There's a lot of different things. I mean, the challenge, first of all, of accomplishing something that you've never accomplished before. Like myself, I belong to a charity team, so there's that draw to it, to know that those miles you're running are helping someone else. So it's the challenge, it's the fun of running with friends, and it's just being able to accomplish something that you never thought you could.
Now, you were telling me, I think earlier, that you ran your first marathon when you were about 50 years old?
I was 50 when I did my first one, yes.
All right. And why did you want to do it?
There again, it was the draw of running with Team World Vision. They came to speak at my church, so that grabbed my attention. And then just the fact of, can I do something brand new at the age of 50? So I'm like, I'm going to try it.
Had you always been someone who was athletic?
I've always been athletic, I guess, but not as far as like endurance sports or running, more lifting weights. As a matter of fact, friends of mine, when I told them at the gym that I was doing my first one, they just laughed at me because they said, you don't even do cardio. So, you know, totally different.
And was that somewhat inspiration when people sort of, you know, doubt that you can do something like this?
Yes, that's a big thing with me. Tell me that you don't think I can do it, and that's going to make me push harder to not just prove to myself, but to prove to them as well that, you know, no matter what age you are, you can get out and do something new. So.
And what would you tell people that if they want to do this as a goal, you may look at them and they may not seem athletic or maybe they're at that time out of shape. What do you tell them?
You don't have to be in shape. One thing I learned about runners, because a lot of people, they visualize, oh, runners are tall, they're skinny, they're slender. They're not. That was one of the first things I learned. It's all shapes, sizes, ages. We have several on the team that, as far as being athletic, have never been that way before and now are running a marathon. So you just got to follow a training plan. You can't obviously get out there the first day and say, okay, I'm going to run 10 miles. You've got to start out slow, do intervals, you know, walk a minute, run 2 minutes. And it's a jog. It's not an all-out run. So I think pretty much anybody that puts their mind to it can do this.
And so today, the Friday before the Chicago Marathon, what are you now doing to prepare for that, for Sunday's big race?
Well, you're basically going through a checklist to make sure you have everything you need. Trying to rest as much as you can, trying to eat good. A lot of people will, as they call it, carb up, you know, 2 days prior to running. And then myself, where I'm captain of our team, a lot of my stuff is getting the team ready and making sure they're ready. So there's a lot involved.
And you brought a friend into the studio with us, is John Harris of North Judson. John, this is going to be your first marathon.
Yes.
Are you already freaking out about that? Like, what did I get myself into?
I was at first, but I've prepared myself over the last year for it. So the only thing I'm worried about is the weather. So
tell us, what is the process if you're not somebody who's been running marathons? What is the process to be allowed to run it? Because I think some people are under the impression you have to actually be picked or qualify for it.
Well, with this, I'm running with the charity. So the World Vision gets so many slots in the marathon. So I'm running with Team World Vision. So that's how I got started with it and then just started training almost a year ago.
Now you're a very young guy, look athletic type. What do you do to besides running?
I do a lot of stretching in the morning and at night, just to make sure everything's still loose, and because I don't want to get cramps. Mm-hmm. And then I don't lift a lot of weights, just because I don't want to add weight back on. Mm-hmm. So I keep everything light.
But do you play other sports?
I did. I've played anywhere from baseball to football, wrestling.
Mm-hmm. And so what was it then, though, that said, boy, I need to put a marathon under my resume?
It was a life change for me. It was something that was new and was going to be challenging, and showing my kids that if you set a goal, you know, you can accomplish it.
Mm-hmm. And so today, again, what do you think are going to be the stumbling blocks? What are you concerned about for Sunday's race? Or do you feel like you're fully prepared? You're ready?
For me, it's just the weather. I don't like cold weather to run in. Mm-hmm. To me, it not necessarily burns. It hurts your lungs a little bit. So the first, I'd say 3 miles will be an adjustment for me. Mm-hmm. And then I should be okay.
What's the longest you've run?
The longest training run we've done is 20. Mm-hmm. But the longest race I've done, it was the Soldier Field 10 mile.
So, okay. So then you have somebody who right now listening or wherever they're in their car at home and saying, you know, I've always wanted to do that too, but I don't think I have the background for it. What do you think they need to do to start preparing? What should they do? Eating healthy or what?
Eating healthy is a big step, but just finding someone to hold you accountable and finding somebody to run with. It's just a step at a time. A year ago when I started this, I could barely run a mile.
Really?
Yeah. And I would run a mile in about 14 minutes. And now if I run just a solid mile, I'm at about 8.5.
Wow. All right. Now, Glenda, you were telling me, too, that there are some runners that you have as young as, 18 or younger than that?
Last year, we actually had a 16-year-old on the team. You have to be 16 by the date of the marathon. So she started training with us when she was 15, and her birthday was about a month before the marathon. So she was good to go.
So what is your day like on race day? Are you spending the night in Chicago or getting up early to get over there?
Yeah, most of us will be there the night before because you have to get up so early and get ready, get into the start line. So you're up well before daylight. So it's a lot easier on you if you stay the night before, because if you have to commute, you're losing even more sleep. So it's just a matter of getting up, getting ready, get dressed. You got to get to the start lines. You got to have your bib on. You got to be in the right corral where they have you placed at. So,
well, I good luck on Sunday to both of you. I want to thank Glenda O'Meara of Portage and John Harris of North Judson. And good luck to you on Sunday at the Bank of America Chicago Marathon.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us here on Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, besides the Chicago Marathon, there are other sports getting started, including pro hockey and pro basketball. There's even a little hiccup between the NBA, China, and President Trump. And let's not forget the Cubs are still needing a new manager. Joining me for an update is veteran Chicago sports reporter Cheryl Ray-Stout. Hey, Cheryl, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Fantastic. Well, last night, the Chicago Blackhawks opened their home opener anyway for this new season at the United Center. How did it turn out for them?
Well, ended up with a loss, a 5-4 loss, and there was a couple of good things. Andrew Shaw, who was returning after being in Montreal for the last 3 years, he scored 2 gritty goals, and, you know, he had the crowd on his side from the get-go. They had some good moments, but their defense is still lacking. There's something they got to get right because, you know, Corey Crawford can't handle all the pressure he's been getting in front of the net.
What can we expect this season from the Blackhawks? We're still a few years removed from their last championship. Is there still a window or an opportunity for another Stanley Cup?
That's hard to tell right now because they have 5 players left from that championship run, and they have a lot of infusion of young players, a couple of veterans that they signed. But the thing is that they have to play catch up against in their own division, which has gotten better and better, you know, in the last few years. So it's going to be a struggle if they don't straighten out that defense and their penalty kill too. Last night they had three power play goals against them, and they were unable to stop two of them. And one of them was only in 9 seconds. So there's some concern on the penalty kill and their defense. And, you know, Mike, that's going to set the tone for the whole season if Corey Crawford or Robin Lanier has to handle too many shots.
All right. And, you know, even though it's, well, it's still technically baseball season. It's playoff season. We've had some exciting games out there. But the Cubs right now are still searching for a new manager. I know Joe Girardi was supposed to interview and David Ross. Where are they at in their search?
Okay, they've interviewed four candidates so far. Mark Loretta last week, they interviewed him. He was their bench coach last season. Will Venable was interviewed on Monday. On Wednesday, they had an 8-hour interview with Joe Girardi. And then yesterday, they interviewed David Ross. Now, of those four candidates, they know three of them very well. And that's why Joe Girardi having an 8-hour interview wasn't surprising. There are two candidates left. One, Joe Espada, who is the bench coach for the Houston Astros. And the issue with that is they can't talk to him until the Astros are done with the postseason. And the last one is Carlos Beltran, who they have to ask the Yankees for permission to, because he's an advisor for Brian Cashman, the general manager there. So it's going to take a little while before they have an announcement of who it's going to be. And the other issues that they have is there are eight openings right now in baseball. And so they're competing with other teams. And some of these candidates, like Joe Girardi specifically, is also on the radar for the New York Mets. So they want to make sure that they get the right person, but they also want to make sure that they have some expediency to it and how much money they're going to pay them. Because a lot of teams are going a little bit cheaper with some of their managers, but somebody like Joe Girardi is not going to be cheap.
Cheryl, do you think this is going to be prolonged? Do you think the Cubs are going to make a decision relatively soon?
Well, here's the issue. Major League Baseball will not allow them to have a press conference to announce that until after, you know, if there's a day off. Well, there is no day off right now during the NLCS and the ALCS. So the possibility, the soonest it could be, would be just before the World Series begins. And the other thing is, if the Houston Astros are still in it and they're still, you know, going to talk to Espada, then they'll have to wait till after the World Series. So I'm looking at likely the beginning of November.
All right. And one interesting situation is happening with the NBA. There's an issue. They haven't had this issue with China now. An executive with the Houston Rockets put out a tweet earlier this week in support of the pro-democracy demonstrators in Hong Kong. And that didn't sit too well with China, which has now taken off NBA games on Chinese TV. This is an issue that even President Trump is talking about, even leveled some criticism against NBA coaches Steve Kerr and East Chicago's own Greg Popovich, the coach of the Spurs. Let's take a listen.
Are the Chinese wrong to be putting pressure on the NBA, sir?
Well, the NBA is a different thing. I mean, I watch this guy, Steve Kerr, and he was like a little boy. He was so scared to be even answering the question. He couldn't answer the question. He was shaking. Oh, I don't know. I don't know. He didn't know how to answer the question. And he'll talk about the United States very badly. I watched Popovich, sort of the same thing, but he didn't look quite as scared, actually. But they talk badly about the United States, but when it talks about China, they don't want to say anything bad. I thought it was pretty sad, actually.
Well, we all know that Steve Kerr and Greg Popovich do not criticize the country, but have been kind of critical of President Trump. So, Cheryl, this seems to be like a really thorny issue with the NBA. You got a thing of freedom of speech here in the country, but, you know, China's a big market for them.
Yeah, it's between a rock and a hard place right now. When the Houston GM put out that tweet, it started a firestorm. And the NBA has always been known as allowing their personnel to speak freely about anything, including politics. And so Then they have the problem with China is now very upset, very angry, as not showing games, is threatening to cut things off. So they're at a stalemate as far as that goes. And it's going to be difficult to see what the impact is going to be financially, because China is also very important financially for the NBA, and it may affect the salary cap for next year. And here's the other thing, Michael, is a lot of players, and I know one specifically that I knew a lot about was Derrick Rose, had deals with China, and they would go overseas, and that's how they would sell their shoes. So individually, some of these players will be impacted too. I don't know what's going to happen, but I do know that Adam Silver is going to meet with Yao Ming, who is very much involved with the Chinese Basketball Federation in Shanghai, and Yao Ming is very mad at the NBA right now. So they have to smooth some feathers, but also not take away the right of the players and management to speak out when they want to speak out.
Thank you so much, Cheryl, for being here again on Off Mic. You can hear more of Cheryl's Ray Stouts of reporting on WBEZ. Have a nice weekend, Cheryl.
You too, Mike.
Presidents and politicians, global leaders and grassroots activists, Democracy Now! Talks with all sides of the story to get the most comprehensive look possible at the changing global landscape. I'm Amy Goodman. Together with Juan Gonzalez, we host the award-winning independent news hour, Democracy Now!, getting the answers to questions you may have or may not have thought of, or maybe you didn't even think they were important at all, but now are intrigued. Tune in every Monday through Thursday at 1 p.m. for Democracy Now! Here on Lakeshore Public Radio and streaming online at lakeshorepublicmedia.org.
Well, Lee Botts grew up in Nebraska during the Dust Bowl. She and her family eventually made their way to Chicago, where she became a strong advocate for the environment, working both for the late Chicago Mayor Harold Washington and Mayor Richard M. Daley. But Lee eventually found her way to Northwest Indiana, living in the Miller Beach area of Gary.
The general public doesn't realize why this area is considered globally important from a scientific perspective. I have prickly pear cactus growing under oak trees in my yard. This is the only place in the world where that happens. And that's understanding the connection between plants and how they adapt to the place where they live, and the articulation of that idea by a man named Henry Chandler Coles in 1898. Is the reason that Northwest Indiana is, in science, considered the birthplace of ecology in North America.
Well, joining me in studio to talk about Lee Botts' life and her legacy is Dan Plath, who's with the National Park Service, and by phone from Canada, where she's attending a conference, Kay Nelson of the Northwest Indiana Forum. Thank you both for being here on Off Mic.
Thank you. Hi, Kay.
Thanks.
Well, let's start with you, Dan, since you're in studio here. You consider Lee Botts as a mentor. You've known her for about 20 years. What are you going to remember mostly about Lee Botts?
There's so many things. I mean, her legacy is incredible. Before I came into the studio, I looked and, you know, when somebody has a Wikipedia page and it's about 3 pages long, you know you've accomplished a few things in your life, but me personally, she was always kind of sounding board for crazy ideas. She was very high energy like I am. I always had these ideas, and she was kind of my sounding board, who I would take and, you know, bounce things off of. Will this work? How does that work? And so forth. But you know, so many different things over the years, so many different memories. Just hearing her voice there in the beginning brings back so many.
You're right. You know, you going back, and I've been covering Lee for several years, but getting to know her over the years, you get to know that she had her hand in so many different environmental issues in Northwest Indiana, things that we have long forgotten. What do you think, and you're every day you're almost at the Dunes Learning Center, where she spearheaded that project. What can you tell us about that?
Very much so. And also the National Park. She was really very instrumental in the early days of the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshores formation in 1966 as part of the Save the Dunes Council. And later on in 1997, 1998, she helped working with the National Park as well as with local industry and other environmental groups formed the Dunes Learning Center, which is this very innovative residential learning center where kids will come there, learn about the dunes, learn about the ecology. And for many kids, it's really the first time they even get a chance to see Lake Michigan. So it's and they put usually about 5,000 kids a year through this program. So it's something that the National Park is very proud of and you know, has a strong partnership with.
Now, Kay, you're up in Canada right now attending a conference for the Northwest Indiana Forum, but you dealt a lot with LEBOTS and capacity in dealing with industry and the different issues. What do you remember about LEBOTS and how she was able to deal with you?
Well, thank you for the opportunity. And like Dan, hearing Lee's voice was a little, made you choke up a little bit because she was so instrumental to us as individuals, as well as to the region that don't know about how much she actually got done for us. But, you know, I first met Lee in my municipal career, which is probably about 35 years ago, and she was very interested in making certain that all stakeholders were at a table for discussion purposes. And through her guidance and wisdom and tenacity, I got the opportunity to work with her to do just that. How do I pull more people to the table to talk about industrial issues concerning the environment and sustainability? And so, you know, there are a number of memories there that at some point during this call I'd like to share further.
Well, Kay, you know, we're living in a time now where so many things are so polarized, especially with the environment. Either you're on this side or you're on that side. And there's really no room anymore, or it seems like, for dialogue or for just negotiations and talking things over. And LEBOTS was never about that. She was always about coming to the table and trying to hammer out a deal. It might be a deal that everybody may not get everything they want, but she wanted something. Everybody would walk away with something. You saw that happen firsthand. Do you remember of a situation where she was instrumental in bringing both sides together to, you know, to deal on an issue?
Well, as I'm sitting up here in Canada attending the Great Lakes Commission meeting, one of my favorite memories about Lee that I shared with the group yesterday afternoon is when it came to the Great Lakes Compact, Great Lakes St. Lawrence River Basin Compact, which governs water use and water quantity in our Great Lakes. And Lee sat at the table with my industry guys, and we hammered through the language that was being proposed for that compact, and then continued to stay at the table with us as we worked on the language that eventually became state law. And Lee and I were successful in creating a joint resolution that was signed on to by the Northwest Indiana environmental groups at the time and the major industries along the shoreline in support of the Great Lakes St. Lawrence River Basin Compact. We read that resolution of support into the record in 2006, at which time Sam Speck from Ohio leaned across the podium and looked at the two of us and said, "Could you please come to Ohio and teach our folks to get along?" I have to say that in my 42 years, that's one of the highlights of accomplishments for my career, to be able to have done that with Lee. And, you know, following that, the work to do the adoption language in Indiana state law, when we went down for the signing ceremony, a group of us, Lee would not go with us because there was black ice, and she didn't want anybody to travel to pick her up, and et cetera, et cetera. So we're traveled to Indy. Governor Daniels signs the bill into law and was very distraught over the fact that Lee was not there. He recognized her value to the success of where we were at that point in time. Through working with the governor's people that day, we identified that the governor was coming to Maryville the following day, which happened to be Lee's 80th birthday, And I was charged with getting her to a location to meet with the governor without telling her that that's what was happening, whereby he presented her with the pen that he used to sign the bills into law. When Lee went to her birthday party later that evening in Chicago, her first words to her son Paul and daughter Beth were, "You are not going to believe what happened today. Look at this pen." It was a moment of pride for her, too. And I mean, that, I think that Northwest Indiana needs to recognize how valuable Lee was to those conversations taking place amongst the environmental stakeholders and the industrial community and municipalities on so many different levels.
Yeah, and earlier this week, Lee Botts passed away last Saturday, and in speaking to her children, Paul and Beth Botts, you got a sense of she had such a long and fulfilling life, and her dealings, I mean, we're not even going to get to it in this segment, but her dealings in Chicago with Mayor Harold Washington and Richard M. Daley and bending their ears, she was way in deep into Chicago politics. But later in life, one of her two big accomplishments, even Paul Botts has said, was both establishing the Dunes Learning Center. And of course, one of her big accomplishments is the documentary, the award-winning documentary, Shifting Sands, also helped produce and directed by Pat Wisniewski. Let's take a little clip about the Shifting Sands documentary.
On the south shore of America's Great Lakes, there exists an ecological marvel unlike any place else in the world.
The topography here, it exists no place else on the planet.
This is probably one of the most studied landscapes in America.
Here, 10 distinct ecosystems combine to produce an immense array of life.
And that is the Shifting Sands documentary. Now, a lot of people take for granted when it's summertime, you just go out to the beach and the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore just became a national park. That took a lot of effort. A lot of people feel that documentary, you know, helped push that effort along. And Dan, you're out there all the time. When you go out there now, you're going to be thinking about Lee Botts. She helped in large part help create this national park now we have in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, absolutely. I've said that from last few years, that between Lee's efforts and Patty's helping push this documentary through and making it, I don't think we would be a national park. I think we would still be a national lakeshore if that documentary weren't made. And I think it really has made, even in this short period of time since last year when we were, or earlier this year when we were made a national park, you're noticing a lot more attention, many more people who are coming to visit the park, but I think a greater appreciation from local communities for what a great asset we have in Northwest Indiana with the national park.
Well, Dan is with the National Park Service. I want to thank him for being here. And Kay Nelson of the Northwest Indiana Forum, thank you for being on Off Bite to talk about Lee Botts.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be back
thank
in just
you,
a minute.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Going down on the farm with Let's Eat. This Friday, we're traveling to Maryville Farms. Let's meet at the barn, pull up a bale of hay, and visit with Ginger, the farmer's daughter, that runs day-to-day operations of Maryville Farms. Call in 769-9577 and ask Ginger your horticultural questions and win a gift card from Maryville Farms. Visit the farm this Friday at 3 o'clock. On Let's Eat with Sharon Jackson and me, Chef Nick, as we pick pumpkins with Maryville Farms on 89.1 FM, Lakeshore Public Radio, WLPR. Call in and join the fun. Yasu.
Now, the Porter County Public Safety Communication System is now in line with the rest of the state. Lakeshore Public Radio, Sharon Jackson, talked to Portage Mayor John Cannon about why the upgrade was needed, how it benefits Porter County, and what it finally took to get the job done.
So tell me about the countywide upgrade to the Porter County Public Safety Communication System. Why was the upgrade needed?
Well, the upgrade was needed. It was required by the state to get us all on the same megahertz radio system. And it was part of the E911 Integrated Public Safety Commission process through the state officials.
When did the project finally come to a close?
Well, it went on yesterday, went up yesterday morning, and then it's worked overnight and all day today perfectly. So that's what we were waiting for.
And how is the communication system better now than before?
Well, we can speak to the rest of the state. Prior to that, Porter County was on an antiquated old system. The rest of the state was connected with towers and connected with the rest of the counties in the state. And we were the lone island up here in northwest Indiana between Lake and LaPorte County and then our Jasper and Newton. We were not able to talk with them over the megahertz. We had to either do it the old-fashioned way by picking up the phone or cell phones because we were the only ones on the 800 megahertz.
So you guys were the only ones that weren't part of the new system?
Our county was not just Portage, our county. We were not able to speak via the 700 megahertz system to the surrounding counties. We were the only county that was not switched over to the 700 megahertz system.
How come?
Well, there were some difficulties with some towers. The E911 director had been changed over a few times. That delayed it. And when I got here in March, I was told by my chief of police and chief of fire that this was occurring, that there was a problem with the communications between a couple companies, that the federal government did not allow the two companies to talk to one another because they were competitors. And I just thought that was just kind of, you know, not the correct answer. So I met with Commissioner Biggs of Porter County, and that same day or a couple days later, I was in a meeting with the governor and with Senator Charbonneau, and I told them both or asked them both if they were aware that Porter County was not on the new integrated public safety requirements, and they did not know that, and they said they would help immediately. And the next couple days, we had word that the tower in Hebron, which was holding the process up, and the tower at the Port of Indiana that was holding the process up, would be tested and up and running, and we would expect something to be done mid-September. And we just got up. It was ready to go mid-September, but they were doing some testing. Wanted to make sure it was, you know, all the I's were crossed and the T's were dotted and all that. That's funny. I said that the wrong way. But anyway, the system would be up, and it got up yesterday on the 8th of October. So moving along pretty fast. It's been going on at least since 3 years ago, and it was supposed to be up and running March of 2018.
So what time did you guys switch it on?
Yesterday morning. I don't know the exact time.
So I understand that during the process and with the delays you were speaking of, you were concerned that, you know, the first responders were, it kind of put them at a disadvantage, even in danger.
Yes.
Can you tell me why and how?
Well, they you know, we have a lot of cross county encounters with Lake County and LaPorte County on the other side. I mean, I'm particularly concerned about the Lake County side because we border it, and we were unable to speak, you know, with our partners on the Lake County side in law enforcement of you know, switching over a chase of a car or investigating something that might have happened in Lake County but then moved over into Porter County or into Portage. We'd have to do it the old-fashioned way with a cell phone or with just you know, meeting up and talking things over, which is, you really can't do that in a high-speed chase or a tracking situation. You need to have the same radios because when you're tracking someone or chasing someone, you really don't pay attention to the county line. You pay attention to who's up next you can hand it off to, and that put our folks in danger as well as the other side of the county in danger because they couldn't talk to us and didn't know what was heading their way maybe. So it put us in danger. Now, we also purchased the radios because we were required to purchase the radios through the Integrated Public Safety Commission 3 years ago, and we've been paying for the police radios all that time, $116,000 a year to set in a closet. And through all that time, if we'd have been on, like we should have been on the system, the upgrades would have came to the radios. Now, before this turn on yesterday, we had to send all of our radios out to get upgraded because what we missed over the last 3 years, that would have came during the system being up. So we were at a disadvantage there as well. They were sitting in a drawer. Now, what's really nice is our fire department had their radios are dual band. They could do the old and the new.
Well, that's our show for today. I'd like to thank our guest producers, Dee Donson, Michael Gonzalez, Jose Rodriguez, and Tom Maloney. You can hear this program again on lakeshorepublicradio.org. Thank you for listening to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio with me, Michael Puente. You can hear me the rest of the week on WBEZ in Chicago. Have a great weekend.